Hello, friends. It's the Environment Show, and welcome. Clean Air Plan for East Coast, held up by EPA. A 12-state consortium has submitted to EPA a plan of action to achieve cleaner air, but the federal agency has no decision yet. One counterproposal could affect the entire nation. The cars of the future are now. And for West Virginia, the Canaan Valley Wildlife Refuge, the 500th to be added to the federal system.
So it is the highest valley of its size east of the Rockies. It is the largest wetland in West Virginia and the largest wetland in the central and southern Allegheny Mountains.
The Environment Show, a national production made possible by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CARHERE, and by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York. This is Bruce Robertson. The wheels of government grind exceeding slow. Nearly a year ago, 12 states in the Northeast and Mid-Atlantic region working together in what is known as the OTC, the Ozone Transport Commission, submitted to the Environmental Protection Agency in Washington a plan to reduce regional air pollution. The plan would pressure the auto industry to supply low-emission vehicles, LEVs, and ZEVs, or zero-emission vehicles, electric cars. The EPA had 9 months to rule whether the plan was compatible with goals of the Clean Air Act. The November 10th deadline for decision came and went, and no phone calls or special delivery mail from the EPA. Trudy Cox is Secretary of Environmental Affairs in the state of Massachusetts, one of the states of the OTC.
We are hoping that EPA will come to its senses. There's a very important reason why we think, actually two, why we think a low-emission vehicle is necessary. Number one is, again, because the current cars that are being manufactured still represent about 50% of the air pollution problems that we are encountered with. And secondly, we have an obligation as a result of the Clean Air Act to find a way to reduce our pollution sources. And so as a state regulator, each one of us has to find somebody to go after. Now, we've seen tremendous strides made on the utility front. There's not a whole lot more, at least in Massachusetts, that our utilities can do. They've already spent a tremendous amount of money and lowered their pollution emissions substantially. We've put a lot of pressure on the manufacturing sector. There's resistance, I think, on the part of the public to require people to carpool and to mass transit. And so that almost becomes, you know, nobody wants to be told that they can't use their barbecue. That may work in California. It's not going to work in this part of the country. So you go after the utilities. You go after the manufacturers. You ask individuals to make some sacrifices. And yet we still have air pollution problems. That leaves the car issue. And so we're hopeful that a combination of low-emission vehicles and zero-emission vehicles, electric cars, can really solve that problem of reducing the emissions and keep us in compliance with the law.
That, in essence, is the OTC plan for reducing air pollution along the eastern seaboard. The plan is a good one, says Mary Nichols, head of the Air and Radiation Office at the EPA, and the EPA did not mean to let the deadline pass. It's just that, well, there was a problem.
Well, we were caught up in the problem under the Administrative Procedures Act that we were required to do a rulemaking on this petition. We couldn't just say yes or no based on how we feel about the petition. We had to publish a notice in the Federal Register, hold a public hearing, invite public comment, and then under the Federal Administrative Procedures Act, we're also required to respond in writing to every comment that is sent in, not necessarily word for word, but at least to summarize and to respond to the points that are made. We received over seven file drawer size boxes of comments, not only from the auto industry, but from states and other interested parties as well. And many of those comments were filed on the last day before the deadline for the close of the comment period. And we simply were not able to get through all of our legal work before before we could come out with a final decision. So we did two things. First of all, we notified all the parties that we would be coming out with our decision by mid-December. So we're talking about a delay of approximately 1 month beyond the time when we should have made the decision and hope to have made the decision. And then secondly, we also told the states that they could go ahead in doing their air quality plans, which they're required to prepare, and assume that the emissions reductions that are called for in the petition would be available to them. In other words, we gave them the benefit of the petition being granted, even though we hadn't actually granted the petition.
As you might expect, there are objections to this whole matter coming in from all points, some saying it does not go far enough, others claiming it goes far beyond anything feasible. The Natural Resources Defense Council is joining with member states of the OTC in a plan to file suit against the EPA for passing the deadline. NRDC attorney David Hawkins says the EPA may meet their new deadline, then again, they might not.
If they indeed issue this decision by the middle of December, then the lawsuit will not be necessary.
So once it's delivered, you will then withdraw your intent?
Well, there is no need for a formal withdrawal. The letter that has been sent to EPA states that if the action isn't taken within 60 days, that the parties, the signers of the letter, would intend to go to court to get the law enforced. So if EPA, in fact, does act within 60 days, then there would be no need to withdraw the letter, because the letter says that we'd only be going to court if the agency hadn't acted.
So in a sense, you would have accomplished your goal by one way or the other.
That's right, and that's one of the purposes of the notice, is to give the agency 60 days to bring itself into compliance.
A brief analysis of the Ozone Transport Commission's proposal for achieving cleaner air. Is it a good plan, do you think?
Yes, we do think it's a good plan. It's one component of an overall program to deliver cleaner air to the Northeast, but it's a very important component. We have been regulating motor vehicles, automobiles, for more than 20 years, and they continue to be a major source of air pollution and will continue to be a major source of air pollution into the foreseeable future. And this program requires stricter pollution controls on conventional types of automobiles. But importantly, in addition to that, it requires the manufacturers to start innovating and coming up with vehicles that are more durable and have many environmental benefits, and the electric vehicles are a good example of that, the so-called zero-emission vehicles.
In filing the notice of intent to sue, the NRDC seeks to speed up the process and implement the OTC plan sooner. The American Automobile Manufacturers Association would rather scrap the plan altogether. The association's Michael Stanton says the car is not the problem.
The auto manufacturers have done a tremendous amount to clean up the tailpipe. A matter of fact, the standards that are on the books will result in a 98% cleanup of tailpipe emissions from the pre-controlled levels of the 60s. So we're more at a point of getting the last drop out than being the uncontrolled source. So we know that because of all of the use of the automobile, that we're probably about one-third of total emissions, the other two-thirds coming from other mobile sources like heavy-duty trucks and airplanes and boats, but then also stationary sources as well. So we're about a third of the active inventory, and of course we have been moving to reduce emissions, and our proposal that we've got out there would even reduce emissions from the tailpipe even further.
All right, let's talk about your proposal. The proposal that is being floated right now is to adopt what's called the California standard, which would mandate a certain percentage of zero emission vehicles, and the only zero emission vehicle we have right now is the electric vehicle. What's your proposal to counter this? We understand you believe that this, although technically could be done, economically should not be done.
Well, yeah, it's two things. It's first of all, you're exactly correct. The ozone transport region in the state of New York want to import the requirements that we've got to meet in California, which has a requirement that 2% of our vehicles beginning in 1998 be electric or zero-emission vehicles, and by the year 2003, fully 10% of our vehicles would have to be electric. The problem with that is that the technology's not there. We are spending an awful lot of money with the United States government to develop batteries that will work. But right now, we haven't had the technological breakthrough that will allow us to put out a vehicle that will operate in the sense of range of an internal combustion engine or be competitive in the sense with cost. And quite honestly, we just don't see how we can market something that is going to cost a lot more and do a lot less. So what we've come up with is a proposal that would take some of the lower emission standards that are in California and build a vehicle to those standards, which is called the low emission vehicle, and then sell it in all 49 states. And because of the geographic area of the Northeast, and the tourism and travel into and out of the states, the emissions reduction is equivalent to the states requiring the more exotic fuels and the more exotic technology, such as zero-emission vehicles. So we're able to get the exact same air quality benefit at a much lower cost using technology that we understand and not requiring the additional costs of developing an infrastructure to support alternative fuels.
Michael Stanton of the Automobile Manufacturers Association. The industry says we can have electric vehicles in showrooms if we really want them, but at a tremendous sticker price cost. In fact, says Stanton, the sticker price would be so high, nobody would buy. To make electric vehicles more competitive, Stanton says, the costs would have to be in line with more conventional vehicles' sticker prices. But Stanton says the industry simply cannot lower its prices on electric vehicles and stay in business at the same time, unless the costs are evenly spread to all other cars, up to $4,000 more, he says. Not true, says Massachusetts's Secretary Cox.
We've heard that argument used by the auto industry in other examples. For example, when Massachusetts is a little different than the other Ozone Transport Commission states, as is the state of New York, because we passed our own low-emission vehicle laws in 1990. And so we've already alerted, through our own state laws, the Detroit manufacturing industry that they had until 1998 to provide us with cleaner cars every year, and ultimately by 1998, 2% of the cars sold in Massachusetts will be electric vehicles. So the thought was that it would be able to push the technology forward with a date certain and would give the industry enough time to get ready for that. It wasn't an overnight expectation. It was 8 years of leading people forward, getting closer and closer to the cleanest car that we could possibly find. But we've heard in the past, you know, back in the 1990s, when the law was written in Massachusetts, the argument was, well, come 1995, when the transitional low-emission vehicle is on the marketplace in Massachusetts, you're going to see very high prices. Well, you know, two analyses have been done in the last 3 weeks of the model year 1995 cars, which are transitional cars. They are cleaner than the cars in Connecticut, New Hampshire, Vermont. And guess what? Our cars are selling for the same price as every other car in New England. So that argument that oftentimes is made that, oh, it's going to up the ante of the car, is simply not correct.
Mary Nichols at EPA says this cost argument may have held water once, at a time when it took government intervention in the form of legislative mandates to prod the auto industry along.
And I think that, frankly, in the early stages when there was great resistance and skepticism about whether there would ever be electric vehicles out there at all, that the mandate was a very important tool in convincing the auto companies to put resources and energy into developing a really attractive electric vehicle. I tend to think that hump has been overcome. and that now it's time to look at what some of the other obstacles to a more widespread use of electric vehicles might be.
The biggest obstacle, probably, is customer preference. But it is likely that low-emission vehicles and the electric vehicles will be a part of our lives, just the way all other vehicle developments in years past have become. It is believed that one day we will have a wide choice of vehicle and fuel types to choose from. The problems being hashed out in the Ozone Transport Commission region are likely to be seen, and the answers applied, everywhere in the country where there is air pollution caused by mobile sources, cars. In the meantime, one way or the other, the OTC will have an answer from EPA on whether the plan conforms with Clean Air Act regulations. Either the EPA will meet its own deadline, or the courts will force it to. This is Bruce Robertson. Cassettes of weekly environment shows are now available by calling 1-800-747-7444. If you'd like yours this week, ask for The Environment Show, program number 256. That's 1-800-747-7444. The Environment Show, program number 256. Environmental history was made recently in a small corner of West Virginia. The U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service has designated a high mountainous region known as Canaan Valley as the nation's 500th National Wildlife Refuge. Located in the north-central part of the state, right now the refuge is little more than 100 acres. Over time, it is hoped, thousands of acres will be added as they are acquired from private property owners. Key in making this happen was Gail Baker of the Wildlife Service. She works out of the field office in Elkins, West Virginia. Ms. Baker, tell me, why was this area thought to be well suited to be a wildlife refuge?
Well, this area is a very unique ecosystem. And several years ago, about 15 years ago, the Fish and Wildlife Service was able to purchase lands that are unique ecosystems. Prior to that, the main money that we had came from the Migratory Bird Treaty Act, and so they had to be migratory bird areas. Anyway, Canaan Valley itself is a very unique ecosystem. It is 3,200 feet above sea level, and that's the floor of the valley, and then there are mountains around it. So it is the highest valley of its size east of the Rockies. It is the largest wetland in West Virginia and the largest wetland in the central and southern Allegheny Mountains. All this kind of combines to make it have some very unique plants, primarily, because it's kind of like a little bit of Canada that's been transposed to West Virginia. So you've got things like red spruce that are very typically northern, cotton grass, sphagnum bogs, a lot of things that are just very northern species. And there they are, south of the Mason-Dixon line. I mean, it's pretty special. Another thing we have there are black ducks spend a lot of time there in the winter and some of the springs. It's also a very important woodcock migrating area.
So what happens when attractive land such as the Canaan Valley and others around the country get designated as a wildlife refuge? What is the significance of such a designation?
Well, mainly once the thing gets established, even with a very few acres, it basically means that we can now sort of legally buy more lands and get the refuge bigger. And the lands that we actually own, we manage. Now, in this case, we're only managing 141 acres. But if we get, you know, let's say, another 3,000 acres in the next year, then we'll manage 3,141 acres. So the Fish and Wildlife Service will manage those lands for wildlife, for the unique things that are there. There won't be any development. But also, people pretty much are allowed to use the area in a place like West Virginia, where in the Canaan Valley hunting and fishing are have been going on for, you know, centuries. That would certainly be a use that we would, I'm sure, allow.
Would you allow these sorts of activities and others, camping and hiking as well, too, but being done under more of a closer supervision, a scrutiny, or just freely without supervision?
Well, obviously we would supervise, and there's certain things that we would allow and certain things we wouldn't. But camping is something that sometimes refuges have camping and sometimes they don't. Camping, of course, really takes a lot of supervision and people to empty the garbage cans and things like that, and Fish and Wildlife is not a really wealthy agency, so actually day use in this area would probably be more likely to be permitted and not camping, because there are some camping areas nearby that people can use. So hiking, wildlife watching, photography, hunting, fishing, those kinds of things would be allowed for sure. Environmental education type activities and things like that, interpretive type things where we kind of explain, like, what's so important about wetlands. This is going to be a great place. Oh, it already is, because we have a wonderful balsam fir swamp in the 141 acres we already have, which is really very special, and that's the kind of thing we can kind of explain to the public what's special about it and why wetlands are so important.
What about the reaction of the West Virginians who live in proximity to the proposed, well, the refuge as it is now and the proposed expanded refuge eventually? What's the general sort of the attitude, I guess, about taking land that was formerly in some other type of holding, either private property or some industrial ownership or some other use that now will be off limits. You know, in this day and age when there's a great deal of discussion about private property ownership rights and the compensation for such, what's the attitude in West Virginia about this?
Well, first of all, I would definitely say that it is divided. We have people who are staunch supporters who think we should, you know, just take the land, condemn the land. There are other people, of course, who are staunch detractors who feel that, you know, they tried to stop the refuge and they may continue to try and stop it from getting any bigger. But let me make one point, and that is that the Fish and Wildlife Service only gets land from willing sellers, and we pay fair market value. We have to by law. So the fact is that if somebody decides, and somebody has decided within the boundary to put in a golf course, there's no way we can stop that. And so there probably will be golf courses, and there are some homes and farms and things within the boundary. The boundary is just something drawn for biological reasons, and we will try to acquire lands within that boundary, but we will not go in and condemn the land or take it. And in fact, I don't think we would stop any, I mean, it wouldn't be very likely for us to say buy a golf course and turn it back into a, you know, a field for deer to graze in. We will look at the lands that are not developed, and this is the thing, there are a lot of undeveloped lands there. And if willing sellers want to sell them to us, we'll take them. If not, we won't. And it's going to be a patchwork, and it probably will stay a patchwork for many years and maybe forever. But that's okay.
Gail Baker, manager of the Canaan Valley Wildlife Refuge in West Virginia, the newest addition to the nation's wildlife refuge system. Though the sanctuary is small now, Baker hopes one day to secure thousands of acres for the Canaan Valley Wildlife Refuge. She says the valley today tells very little of its past, when most of the spruce forests were cut down in logging operations. Today, standing on the mountain ridge looking down, Baker says the valley appears unspoiled. With its new federal designation, the valley will now remain unspoiled. This is Bruce Robertson. And that's our report on the Environment Show for this week. We're glad you joined us today, and we hope you'll make a note. Tune in again next week for more news on the environment. The Environment Show is a program about the environment, the air, water, soil, wildlife, and people of our common habitat. Thanks this week to production assistant Linda Anderson. The Environment Show is a presentation of National Productions, solely responsible for its content. Dr. Alan Shartok, executive producer. This is Bruce Robertson. The Environment Show is made possible by the J.M. Kaplan Fund of New York and by Hemmings Motor News, the monthly Bible of the old car hobby, 1-800-CAR-HERE.